Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 106, recorded March 26, 2012.
Greetings all, this is the anticipated Ponds episode with our guest...
Ken Jones.
The Prince of Ponds.
Some aquatic royalty.
So... Not every day you have aquatic royalty.
It's true.
So, welcome, Ken.
Well, hello, everybody.
And thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, we're excited, too.
So, as we've mentioned, Ken is known as the Prince of Ponds because he has extensive experience with all sorts of water features.
Well, I should correct that. I don't know that I'm known as the Prince of Ponds. That's what I call myself. Lord knows only what I'm known as. I don't know what they say about me elsewhere, but that is the name I picked just for fun.
Okay. Well, we know you as Ken Jones, the Prince of Ponds, so there you go.
And it's a snappy title.
It is.
Well, it's fun, and I have been called a Prince of a Guy.
There you go.
So it's well-deserved. So we wanted to talk to you about things we need to know if we're going to set up a pond or if we're even contemplating setting up a pond, kind of the top 10 considerations when you're going to put a water feature up or you're going to set one up. So let's dig in. What would you start with?
Well, you know, you asked me to prepare something to give a thought to this topic, and I've done so, and it's quite a list. But I'll be glad to go through it and ask me any questions you have, and ask me to elaborate or to move on whenever I need to, because unfortunately I love this topic, and I can talk about this for hours, and I don't think you want to make this a two or three or four parter, so we'll try to keep it down to 20 or 30 minutes. Let's see here. Oh, before I go on, I must say, and I've said this before, and I will say it again, I love you guys, and I love your show. I love the chemistry between you, and I love the fact that you're willing to donate so much time to help other people in the aquarium hobby. And, Russ, I appreciate your expertise in invertebrates. That's hard to find. It's hard to find anybody who's got knowledge about invertebrates in aquarium keeping. And I think it's a very important topic. And I consider you a very valuable resource. So I am thrilled to be able to get to know you two. And anything I can do to help, I'd be glad to. So again, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, well, thank you. And we appreciate that. I have also enjoyed listening to your podcasts. I've learned a lot. I'm up to episode 4 now, and I've really enjoyed learning everything from a practical standpoint. I mean, you...
Well, you're in trouble. I just finished another one today.
Oh, cool.
Yay.
I'll look forward to that. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun because I have, you know, dabbled a bit in ponds, I guess you could say, but there's so much to learn, and I'm so glad that you give that information, and you're not doing it with an agenda from a standpoint of you're not promoting a specific product because you're selling it. You're just out there to tell us what we really need as potential pond keepers. I love that.
Well, I've always wanted to be more of a consumer advocate than was part of my role through the years. Yeah, I don't represent any particular product. I'm not selling anything at this point in time, anything specifically. I just think there's a need for good information about how to best build ponds. And I think there's a lot of misinformation going on. I frankly think the industry is a little askew, has kind of gone off track from where they should be. And I understand how it got there and why it is and so forth. But I'm hoping to... counter that a little bit with my experience, because I've been doing this for about 30 years, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of ponds and water features, and maintained a lot. A lot of my learning on this topic came from just trying to solve other people's problems, because in the beginning I did mostly maintenance, And I got to see a lot of things that didn't work and the problems that needed to be solved and things that could have been prevented and corrections that needed to happen. And I learned how to do those things. In fact, through the years, I found about half of my work was rebuilding other people's mistakes, which I thought was, you know, really said something pretty important. It said to me, it said that, first of all, that water features needed to be built better in the first place. And secondly, that people so love their ponds that they're willing to pay for them twice just to get them right, you know?
But wouldn't it be great if they only had to do it once at the beginning?
Well, and they can. They can, and I hope I can help with that and maybe just a little bit today. Now, I'm going to mention these 10 tips, but we'll have to go over it pretty quickly in order to fit it all in because there's a lot of material. Let me say on the outset that this information is discussed at my website. And in the library in particular is where there's articles that cover a lot of these topics. Some of them are not complete yet, but there's a lot of good articles, beautiful photographs that really help illustrate this information. So I think it'll be valuable to anyone that wants to know more about these things to visit the website and check out those articles and maybe listen to some of the other podcasts perhaps.
Great.
Yeah, and so would you give everyone a quick... just tell them the URL really quickly now, and then we'll also put it on our page.
There's actually two addresses that go to the same website. You can go to princeofponds.com. That's quick and short. Or you can go to the Ornamental Water Feature Academy. You see, the Prince of Ponds podcast is a production of the Ornamental Water Feature Academy. And so you could go to the ornamentalwaterfeatureacademy.com and get there as well. So either address works to get you to the academy where the articles are and where the podcasts are too.
All right.
Very good.
So tip number one. well, I think one of the first questions one should ask is this water garden in my yard, in my landscape, going to be a hobby for me, or is it going to be a landscape asset? Because there's different approaches to take and different budgets involved. And the fact is, an awful lot of residential ponds that I've seen in my career were actually meant to be part of the landscaping. And landscape design and landscape assets are meant to last a long time and should be well done so that they do last a long time and that they're not maintenance headaches. Now, if a pond is something you're just going to try, it's just going to be a hobby, something to toy with and see if you might want to get involved in a more serious way later, you're unsure of yourself, you're not sure what you want, you don't have much of a budget, maybe you want it to be a hobby. And if so, that's fine. But if it's meant to be an asset for your real estate, if it's meant to be something to enhance the value of your home and something that is a good investment and that you can... benefit by that investment later by the sale of the property or whatever. You want something that's has a greater investment in it and has longevity and is well done and a success. Something that doesn't demand a lot of time or attention. So there's those two ways to approach it. Do you want lasting value? Do you want a design for ease of maintenance? Are you willing to put some money into it, or is it meant to be a hobby? That'll affect the size of your project and just about everything you do with your water, how you approach this water garden, that decision. Tip number, any questions about that before I move on to tip number two?
It just makes a lot of sense. I would never have thought about that, I don't think, but it makes a lot of sense that you need to think about that before you approach it. But I bet most people, when they begin, don't even think about that. So I'm glad you brought
that's
that
really
up.
Really good point.
Yes, I think it can really save you a lot of heartache and trouble if you give that some good thought on the front end. Because a lot of people just kind of stumble into it, not really sure what they want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so they end up investing in things that don't work and spending much more time on it than they meant to. I mean, a lot of my consultations have come from disgruntled pond owners that just haven't been able to find the answers to their questions or the solutions to their problems. And it's usually a very pleasant experience for me because I know I can help them. But it's been a little sad to see so many people hurting over their water gardens, because water gardens can be such an outrageously wonderful thing to have in your life. But they can be awful, too, if things aren't done well. So, tip number two, what size and shape should it be? Well, I would advise people to go bigger than they think they want to. I always say go as big as your budget will allow and as big as your space allows, and then go bigger. Because there's advantages to the larger size. First of all, a larger water garden is more stable. It's easier to maintain. Water clarity is easier to maintain. I've never met a pond owner who wanted to make their pond smaller, but I've met a lot of pond owners that wish their pond were bigger, and some of them that actually have a second pond installed just because the first one just isn't big enough. So I think that's good reason for people to consider that they're going to want it bigger than they think they are, and that larger is better.
Right.
As far as shape, generally a simple shape, an oval in shape with vertical sides to the pond, not real shallow, you know, areas, but vertical walls, and a clean sloping bottom to the pond. You don't want to fill the bottom of the pond full of rock. That's often done, and that's a maintenance headache. You don't really want to do that.
Why do they put rocks on the bottom? Why do they fill it with rocks?
Well, for the first few days, I mean, it's often done by contractors who specialize in this kind of thing, sadly, because, I mean, it looks terrific the day they go to get their final check. You know, it looks good because the water's cleared. There hasn't been time for any algae or debris to build up or leaves to blow in or anything. So on day one, it looks terrific. And having all that rock down there, you can see the rock and it looks great. But what happens, I mean, if we're talking a fish pond here that you're going to put fish and plants in a matter of weeks, you're going to have algae growing over the surfaces of everything below the waterline. And so it obscures the decorative quality of all that rock. And all that rock that looks decorative when the water's clear and the rock's clean becomes just a big green, brown mass shapes. And maintenance headaches because it's hard, you know, leaves and silt hides in all those nooks and crannies around and behind and underneath those rocks that you can't get out without, I mean, how do you get it out? You can't get it out unless you drain the pond and go down and remove all the rock. So it's a very temporary benefit to put rocks in the bottom, and generally it's better to have a clean bottom without the rocks. Point number three, location. Well, you need to decide whether you're going to put it in the sun or the shade. And generally speaking, the sun is better because, and you could do it either way. I mean, this is a choice you get to make. But the benefit of putting a pond in this full sun all day long is that first of all, if you're going the water garden approach, you know you're going to have water plants. A lot of these water plants are blooming, and some of them are very beautifully blooming plants. And water lilies are one of the favorites for good reason. And they love full sun. They will flourish and bloom beautifully in full sunshine. If you put your water garden in the shade under a tree or under anything that provides shade for most of the day, those plants are not going to bloom. Some of them will live, but they won't thrive, and most of them will not bloom in the shade. So that's a consideration. Now, if you don't plan to have any plants at all, then you might want the shade. The shade is fine for the fish, and sunshine's okay for the fish too, although I say that way because it is possible for koi to get sunburn on their foreheads. And you don't want to be out there every summer day, you know, putting the sunscreen on their little foreheads. But that's not a common occurrence, but I have seen it. It does happen sometimes. So, there, you know, koi can get too much sun, but there are ways to mitigate that without the sunscreen. But sun has, generally speaking, you're going to have a more successful complete water garden approach if it's in full sun. Elevations of the landscape is another consideration. You want the pond, you don't want the pond on top of a hill. You want it at the bottom of a hill. If you have no slopes in your landscape, then you might want to create some. In fact, usually excavation of the pond actually creates some extra soil that helps you with that. And you can create some hills around behind the water garden. But in nature, water always accumulates in the low spots. So it only makes sense visually to put your pond in a low point. You also got to think about access to power, electricity, and water, and even drainage, but not so much. drainage, but especially a water source and a power source. You're going to need those for your pond. And then viewing angle, you know, how is this water garden going to be seen from, you know, where's it going to be seen from most often? So that you could take into consideration your location of your patio or deck and maybe the kitchen window or the living room window or whatever. You're going to want this pond where you can see it and enjoy it even when you're not outside. So that's a consideration. And another one might be context, the surrounding landscape. A pond needs to make sense. So it's what goes into this is that, you know, do you want a waterfall? Are you going to planning to have a stream? Where would the stream be located? Again, the stream needs to kind of be in a location that makes sense feeding the pond. And you want the rocks to match. The rocks that you use in your water feature should be similar to the rocks that you might have elsewhere in your landscaping. So you want the water garden to fit your total landscape environment.
Makes sense.
Point number four. Do we have time for point number four?
Oh, yes, we're fine. Yeah.
Do you want to do a break?
Yeah, let's take a break for a second here.
Okay.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
All right, where were we? Point number four?
Number four, style. There's the most common styles for water features are formal and natural. Formal means geometric shapes. A formal pond might be a square pond. I've done some formal ponds that are raised up, you know, so that there's a bench all the way around the pond, and it's a big square, what would otherwise be a fountain, except that they've put water plants and koi in there. There are many ways to do a formal pond, but the natural water gardens, I think, are the most popular, and that's my personal favorite. I like to make ponds to look as natural as possible. So that means a lot of, that means amorphous shapes, asymmetrical balance, natural colors and textures, usually natural, real natural rock used in the decorating of the pond. It means having fish and plants in the pond, a complete living environment. There's also the question of sterile water versus living water. Obviously, if the water is sterile, that means we use chemicals to keep algae and plants and snails and, oh, heaven forbid, all those things from growing in a pond. That's a sterile water feature. And so that wouldn't be considered a water garden. Obviously, that would be considered a formal sterile water feature. And that's what's done for fountains, typically. But if you're going to have living water, water that's alive with living creatures, plants and animals, then that's, you're probably headed towards a natural water garden, and it's going to house fish and plants. But you get to decide what kind of water feature you want and what kind of style you're looking for. And it is possible to mix the two, as I mentioned in the beginning. Some homes are very geometrical and modern looking, with a lot of squares and rounds, forms and so forth. And so a formal water garden might fit there. It might be raised, it might be some geometrical shape, and still have fish and plants in it, but be something that fits the style of the home. So you want it to fit in. You need to consider matching or complementing the style that's already there in the residence or the real estate that you're dealing with.
Most people probably don't even think about that. They just think, oh, let's go pick up a prefabricated liner and drop it in.
Yeah. And then controls. Controls on your water quality and clarity. Those are the two things over time you're going to be most concerned about with your pond, is water quality and water clarity. And water quality and clarity are not necessarily linked. You can have crystal clear water that's toxic, that's poisonous. And you can have very green water that's perfectly healthy. So what most people want is clear water and high quality water so their fish are healthy and their plants are healthy and everything's thriving. A filter system, in most cases, a pond needs more than just a filter. It needs a filter system. And I've taken to calling it a life support system because a good filter system is going to do more than just filter the water. It really is the life support system for that pond. And that's a big subject, and I may touch on it again later, but it's a very big subject, but it's an important one, the equipment that goes into the life support system for the pond. And it's that equipment that gives you, that can give you, if you have the right equipment, can give you absolute control over your water quality and water clarity. Without it, you're going to have to tinker with a phenomenon known as natural balance. You're going to have to tinker with a number of different parameters that will coax your pond to be clear and healthy.
It's just
vague here. It's such a big subject that it's dangerous for me to go any further on the topic. But it's a fun and fascinating part of the whole subject, that's for sure. But I'm going to move on to shells versus liners, because this is an area where, the whole industry, for a long time, the pond industry didn't exist as an industry. And for anyone to get a pond into their real estate, there weren't a lot of places to go. And to get into a pond involved a real commitment to it, and usually meant building a pond out of steel-reinforced concrete. Then the industry, what it was the pond industry was looking for, how do we get a pond into a box? So that way, when customers come into our store, we can send them home with a box with a pond ready to go. You know, that would be the way to promote ponds, to sell more ponds, if we could make it convenient enough that people could take it home and put it in the ground themselves. And simultaneously, the waste industry was developing these liners for handling wastewater. And so we kind of borrowed that material from that industry and cut it down to size for residential ponds, and we've been sticking these liners into cardboard boxes, throwing a pump in, and selling an instant pond for people to take home and install over the weekend. And so we have an awful lot of ponds now that are built, and even so-called professional contractors are installing these ponds using liners. Now, this works. And there are benefits to liners, and I've used liners, and I still believe in liners for certain situations. But I'd like to be known as saying liners are not the best way to build a pond, and I do prefer steel-reinforced concrete shells. They are much more durable. You know, there's just no way a little liner or even a thick liner is going to compete in durability with a steel-reinforced concrete shell. So generally speaking, I say that ponds, especially residential-sized ponds, which we're talking in the anywhere from 6 to 8, you know, 6 by 8 to 10 by 20 or 30 feet, you know, any size range in there would make sense for residents, that they should be built more like swimming pools. So again, another big subject, and I would love to explain that further, but time won't let us do it here and now, but maybe we can do it some other time.
It's good teasers, right?
Yes, and I do have articles on this topic and whole episodes of the Prince of Ponds talk on these topics as well. Now, number 7 is plumbing features. There's a lot of plumbing features you can have, and really a complete pond. I mean, again, from a hobbyist point of view, you know, you got $50 to spend, you want a pond. You know, you might use that old bathtub or a wine barrel or something, and you could have a little miniature water garden, and they're fun. I have two right by my front door, just like that. So I'm all for the little stuff too. But if you want a pond capable of, you know, again, 8 by 10 or 10 by 15 or 20 feet, something in that size range, and maybe have some koi in there, you're going to want a system that's a joy to maintain, and that means you're going to want the following plumbing features in every pond. You're going to want an autofiller, a device to keep the pond full all the time. It just compensates for evaporation and splash. And if you have a waterfall or stream, you are definitely going to have substantial splash and evaporation. And a pond with no turbulence at all, no waterfalls or fountains, on a hot, windy day can lose an entire inch of water from just evaporation. So you'd need an autofiller to keep it full. The second thing is a manual filler. Simple enough, but you want to be able to turn on and get a lot of water in there in a hurry, especially after doing water changes and maintenance procedures. An overflow, so that when it rains or the sprinklers are left on too long or whatever, excess water can get out of the pond and it's not going to flood your surrounding landscape and so forth. You're going to want a sump. Now, sumps are not commonly found in ponds, and it's a shame. I love sumps. Sumps are great. Everybody should have
a
sump.
Chris loves sumps.
And what is a sump? It's usually a square box sunk down in the floor of the pond at the deepest part of the pond. And it gives you a place to, it's a good place to draw your water from, at least some of your water from, and for your circulation system. Because, you know, the heavier stuff tends to end up towards the bottom, and you can pull it down through your strainers down there in the sump. And in so doing, you're also drawing the debris that will occur in every pond. You're going to have some debris. Some of it's generated by the pond itself. Some of it is blown in. But you will have debris, and you want that debris to accumulate someplace out of sight. And the sump is the place for that. And then when you do have to clean that debris out, which you will have to do on occasion, it's easy to get to. It's easy to, it's already kind of, collected for you in one place. It gives you a nice, easy place to rinse your pond down if you're doing an overhaul and taking all the water out and you want to clean it up real good. I call this an overhaul. If you're doing an overhaul on a pond, a sump is a great, convenient thing to have. So sumps are great. Return jets. Now, this is where the water comes back into the pond from the filter system. And whether you have a waterfall or not, you might want to have some return jets placed in good locations to keep that water circulating, to keep debris from building up anywhere else. Return jets provide circulation, which the fish love. It's stimulating for them. It provides additional aeration of the water and moves your debris where you want it to go. So that's why you want return jets. And then the pumps and filters, which I mentioned before, I'm not going to go into that right now, but obviously you want a filter system and some pumps to move the water. And then decorative returns, those are the waterfalls, fountains, and there's a lot of different ways to do that, and there's no right or wrong way, but you just, what looks good to you, you know, is what you want to have in your water garden in the way of decorative returns. So that's plumbing features. Coping, that's item number 8, that's what goes around the pond. Now, one of the things I dislike about the pond in the box kit idea is that they all look alike. They all end up being a liner in a hole with a ring of rock all the way around to hold the liner down. And you don't find that in nature very often. It doesn't look very realistic, and it does look like everybody else's pond in a box. So I'm against putting a ring of rock around the pond. Now, sometimes, you know, maybe it fits if you do going for a formal effect, maybe it's rectangular and you have stepping stones in the landscape and so forth. Man, you know, there's places where, and I got to say, with every rule I have, I'm aware of
exceptions.
You know, exceptions to the rule. There are always exceptions to the rules. But as a rule, I don't like the ring of rock look. I don't think it looks natural, and there are better ways to go. What I like to see is what I call decorative coping. And what I mean by that is a mortar and concrete mixture that's colored and textured to simulate natural soil and stone. Now, it takes a mason to make that stuff, to make it look real and attractive. Someone experienced with this, I think a do-it-yourselfer can do it. If they're not afraid of mortar, you just have to be willing to experiment. But I think you need to do a little practice and experimentation to get it looking right. And I have a podcast that describes the process. Excuse me, for doing that, for making decorative mortar. But basically, you're taking mortar that's been colored and you texture it by rinsing off the cement to reveal the sand and gravel underneath. And you end up with a very natural-looking shoreline that way. You still want to have rock groupings, But you want to have some simple shoreline as well, where the plants can come right down to the water's edge and so forth. So decorative coping is a really wonderful touch for a nice looking pond. And you want an irregular shoreline. It's nice to have little eddies, little corners and irregular shapes in your shoreline. That's especially important if you want to encourage the habitation of gnomes and fairies around your water garden. They really like those kinds of things.
Fairies.
Yes, they like little swimming areas where they can wade in and such. And it gives you a great place to put ferns and little bluebells and other plants that help make for that kind of environment. But that's a nice touch. And then another thing about the coping is I think it's really good to have it step down instead of just having a straight edge coming up out of the water, to have a step to it. And that allows you to put some rock groupings down into the water so that you're not just rocks sticking up around the perimeter of the pond, but some of these rocks are actually, cascading into the pond a little bit. And it provides a much more natural look that way. So a stepped coping is, I often refer to it in my projects as the deluxe coping, but it's a stepped coping. It takes a little bit more work, but it looks great.
And I bet there are certain pond inhabitants that especially appreciate it, like maybe turtles and frogs and things like that.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. They haven't told me, but I think they're happy about it. They look happy about it. Number nine would be decorative lighting. You don't have to have decorative lighting. That can be lighting in the landscape or under the water. But if you have a pond, you're really missing out if you don't have underwater lighting, especially on those summer evenings when you're out around the pond and it's starting to get dark. Underwater lighting is uniquely beautiful. There's something about it. It's the way the water ripples the light that just makes it just gorgeous and mesmerizing. It's really beautiful, especially if you have clear water. So you're going to want to have some underwater lights and then watch your fish swim in and out of the light beams and such. It's great fun. So I highly recommend the decorative lighting. And then we're to number 10, planter pockets. These are underwater planters. Again, something I almost never see, but I've been doing it for years. It's a great success. I love underwater planters. So many ponds have, you can have a very nice looking pond and then they stick out, put these red and blue plastic tubs out there with the water plants in them. Oh. And you got these tubs sitting around in the water that just really don't look natural at all. And, there hasn't been a lot of options. What else can you do to get plants out into your pond? Except that you can build, if you got a concrete pond, you can build concrete planters. And these are just little walled planters that you create usually along the perimeter of the pond, but I have put some out in the middle as well. And they don't, the walls don't come up out of the water. They stay down under the water. The height of these things will be different depending on which kinds of plants you plan to put into these planters. But once the plants get started growing in there, they disguise the fact they're in any kind of container at all. And it's a really nice, classy way to have water plants in your pond. Now, you might wonder, well, how do I transplant or fertilize or care for these plants when I can't move the planters around? And it's true, there's some advantages to being able to haul a tub out of the pond and work with it out of the water. But believe me, there are ways. In fact, maintaining plants in these planters, I think, is at least as easy as working with tubs. And the other advantages just make it really the best way to go. So I believe in planter pockets for number 10. And then I have number 11. Oh, I know. I said 10 tips. But see, I can't stop. I've always got
the bonus feature.
So I had to throw in a number 11 here. So here's my last tip for my top 10 tips is tip number 11. When you if you hire someone to help you build this pond, hire someone with experience. Some people put a lot of emphasis on certificates and licenses and so forth and so on. And I've met so many licensed landscapers that will build a pond for you, but you look into their experience with ponds and they have little to none. And you're gonna have a compromised product. You want someone who's built hundreds of ponds. That's what you want to find. And there's just no substitute for experience because there's no university, not yet. Now, my Ornamental Water Feature Academy promises to be something like this, but we have yet no Institute of Higher Learning when it comes to building or ornamental water features. And so the best way to learn that is through experience. And I think some of the best experience is experience where they're not only building, but they're maintaining. So if you find somebody who's built a lot of ponds and has a maintenance service, this guy's going to know, he's going to know it all. So I would urge you to check on their past projects. I don't care about licenses or certificates. There's a lot of guys that have legal qualifications, but they can't do a decent job when it comes to water features because they get no training in it. There's no formal training in it at all, and you can get a license to build water features and not know anything about water features because you don't need to know anything about water features to get those licenses. That's not what the license is based on. They don't have a license in ornamental water features. You can't get a license. You can't qualify for a license in water gardening. As far as I know, no one's offering that yet. But so that's where the experience come in. So look in, find out what they built before. Go talk to a few customers and see what those ponds are like to live in, you know, live with. Not necessarily in. Now, I live in my ponds. But
unless you're a mermaid.
Most people don't do that. So, but you want to know what those ponds are like to live with, you know, years later.
That's sound advice.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's one thing to build something, one thing to have to deal with it for the next 30 years.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, maintenance is to design these things to provide for the best maintenance situation is very smart and rarely done. So there you go. That's sorry to race through that like that, and I probably created more questions than anything I've answered. But
that's great.
Creating questions is a good thing too.
Yes.
There you have it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I also had a couple of questions that some of our listeners wrote in. One of our listeners from France, she says she has a deck pond, and maybe you can help her with this, or on her balcony, just a small pond with a betta in it that she puts out there during the summer. Uh-huh. And she said she wanted to know how you can tell whether plastic containers are safe to build a water garden, and she wasn't sure about the one she had or how she could replace it. Are there ways to tell whether certain plastics are safe, or do you just have to make sure you use an approved four-pond product, or how does that work?
Well, I'm going to answer that from an experience point of view rather than a scientific one, although I tend to be a fellow that appreciates science. I just don't know the scientific answer to that. But my experience tells me you can use just about any kind of tub or container, plastic container for a water garden, if you will just make sure it's very clean and thoroughly rinsed. In fact, I would not only just rinse it, but I would set it up and soak it for a few days and then replace all the water. And I think if you do that, you're probably going to be fine.
Most of them are pretty safe.
If you have doubts, if you wonder, I mean, there's two things you can do. One is we'll give it a try with something, you know, that you don't mind losing if you were to lose it. I mean, put a dime store goldfish in there at first and make sure he's happy before you put your prized fish in there. Also, you know, put some plants in too, make sure they do all right. But I would start easy if you have any doubts or concerns about that, and don't put your favorite fish or plants in first. The second thing too is, you know, if you have any doubts, you can always. There are a lot of these tubs sold at water garden outlets and water nurseries online and so forth. And anything sold through there is intended, of course, for water features, so they will be safe. So if in doubt, and usually they'll be more attractive. It might cost a little more, but that, I think it's worth it if you can get something that's, well, the right color that doesn't, you know, it's not obtrusive, but, you know, looks right. So I would recommend that too.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Very good.
And then someone else mentioned, what's, of course, water gardens attract children, which is a great thing, as you've mentioned.
And the gnomes and the fairies, right?
Yes. Well, I have a chapter on water garden pests, and I include egrets and raccoons and children in that one.
Yeah, I lived next door to a pond as a child, but I was never allowed to approach within about 20 feet of it because the neighbor jealously guarded it, and if anybody got close to it, he would shoo them away.
What a shame, because ponds are so fascinating. I mean, they just... course they attract children. They attract children of all ages.
Exactly.
You might have a concern about their safety.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, give me a more specific question.
Oh, yeah, I didn't really, I guess I didn't ask it yet, but
no, he was interrupted as usual.
Like, what is the best way to make sure kids are safe around ponds, I guess was his question. Mm-hmm.
Well, to have an adult present at all times. I mean, what could be better or more practical? I mean, if children are too young to, you have doubts about their ability to swim and get out of a pond, should they fall in, then make sure there's an adult there. Now, there are some communities that require fences around any water feature in a landscape. So you have to consider how vulnerable. I mean, in most cases, they take into account, what's reasonable. I mean, if you have a large piece of property and this water feature is not near the road and you have there's not an elementary school across the road from where you live and all these things, it's a fairly isolated location. You're not going to be expected to, put up a chain link fence with a lock around something like that.
Right.
Or normally, it just wouldn't be reasonable. On the other hand, you can imagine situations where a lot of children are present and there just isn't adequate adult supervision, and it could be a danger. So I
just use your common sense.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to see fences around a water feature. I have on my website a picture of a fountain. It's a little fountain in a public park that I came across in a rural community out in the middle of the mountains, okay? And in this little park is this little fountain, and somebody had them put a fence around this little, it's about 6 feet in diameter, but the fountain is completely, you can't get up and touch the water, and you can barely see the statuary, the fountain itself, because
of
this wrought iron fence built around it, And I just think that's nuts. I'm sorry, I just really think that's nuts. So what's the point?
Yeah, it's possible to go too far there.
Yeah. But if you have a yard, some people do have fences. Fences are more and more required to have around property that contains a swimming pool. Now, swimming pools tend to be like, 6, 8, maybe even 10 feet deep and that kind of thing, whereas your typical water garden is only 2 or 3 feet deep. So depth of the pond is a consideration, too. I mean, most kids can stand up in the average water garden if they were to fall in.
That's a good point.
So anybody can fall in and hit their head and they won't be standing up, and there's, you got a real worry there. So there's no perfect answer, and I would urge people to use common sense and simply to have, don't let kids go out and play around a pond by themselves.
Right. I think that's got to be the best approach. Makes sense.
But I would encourage kids to play around a pond and get in there and check out all the neat little critters and splash around and swim with the fish. It's great, great fun. I've done it many times, and it's a wonderful feeling to get out in the middle of a water garden and swim among the lilies and the koi. It's a piece of paradise.
I think some of Russ's favorite kid memories are, chasing down frogs and in the ponds.
We used to live a stone's throw from a lake, and I spent a lot of time in there with the fish and the water lilies and everything, so.
Uh-huh, I believe it. Well, I too. I was a big frog hunter as a little kid. And that was one of my favorite sports.
Yeah, yeah.
Collecting the tadpoles and even the eggs in the springtime and keeping them in jars in the bedroom window and watching them sprout their legs and turn into frogs and stuff. And I loved it. To this very day, the sound of croaking frogs. I have a pond just by great luck, I guess, where I live. There's a pond right across the road from me, and every spring those frogs start crow right about this time of year, and it makes me happy. There's nothing that will automatically put me in a good mood like hearing frogs croaking.
It's a happy sound.
Yeah, we don't have a pond near our house, but we do have a croaking frog in our house, and that's fun too.
He sings to us.
Well, after all, croaking's all about love, isn't it?
That's right.
It's true.
It's all about love.
Well, Ken, we're really glad that you joined us on the show this week, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future.
You mean it's over? We have to stop?
Yeah, well, we don't have to stop. We're just taking an indefinitely...
It's been a lot of fun. I'm very much looking forward to this, and I enjoy your company, and I enjoy the opportunity to talk to your listeners, and I hope I've been of some kind of help.
Oh, you certainly have, I'm sure. Yeah.
I am available for consulting and supervising, and I have a lot of great information, I think, on my website as well, which I'll say again is the Ornamental Water, not the, I should say this correctly, Ornamental Water Feature Academy, or if that's too many letters, that's .com. You can always go to just princeofponds.com. And you get to the same place and enjoy the articles and the podcasts.
And you can also go to iTunes, too, right?
That's true, yes. The podcasts are on iTunes. They're also on the great PetLifeRadio.com, which is a distribution network of pet programs. And they have a lot of good programs over there, and some of the best, I'm happy to say, I have something to do with.
Yeah, you also run the Pet Tech Podcast as well, don't you?
Yes, I do the Pet Tech Podcast, which is aimed at general pet parents and describes some of the science and technology that goes into making the pet products of today more, how do I say, to make the care of our pets easier, safer, and more fun.
So that will be of interest to a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, because I'm not only does that relate to fish as being part of the pets in many families, but a lot of our listeners also keep other creatures. So,
yes, and if I may make one request at this point, very quickly here, I have heard from some leaders in the pet industry that there's some concern that the young people are not, meaning children, the youth, are frankly being distracted by today's technology or gadgets or video games and so forth, and are not involved with raising pets like they used to be.
I believe it. It's very sad.
Yes. I'm putting out a message on all my podcasts asking people to get in touch with me, send me a brief email, and tell me, you know, if they think that's true and what organizations they're involved in and what they're seeing there. Are fewer young people becoming members of aquarium societies? I hear from some that their membership's getting old and they're afraid of what's going to happen, you know, the way things are going, if there's no young people to come in and make up some of the new membership. So I want to find out just how true is this? Is there a lot of this going on? Or there? So I'd like everybody's individual feedback on that. If they think that there's a concern about children not being involved in pet hobbies like they used to be. Because if that is a problem, I have some ideas on how to help that out, how to make that better. But it's a lot of work, and I'm not going to proceed unless I'm sure there's a problem to be solved. So I'm asking for people's feedback on that. Yes. And they can send it to ken@princeofponds.com. Will work nicely. Thanks again for having me on your show and putting up with me for so long. I love your work. I'm glad you're there, and I appreciate you having me on to talk about my favorite subject.
Yeah, well, we appreciate having you on, too. It's been great, and we've been excited about it, and we're glad to learn a lot more about ponds.
Well, if there's anything I can do to help you, just give me a call. You know where I am.
Yeah, we will, and same to you. Anything we can do.
To our listeners, may the ponds
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.